Hello and welcome to the Geeking Review Podcast. I'm Jeremy Pappas, alongside, as always, someone who knows that everything is truly awesome. It's Russell Jones. Russell.
Awesome and awesomer and awesomest.
Everything is awesome. Always remember that.
Especially this tea that I'm drinking right now. Man, I needed some tea.
Tea's good. Tea's good. How you doing?
Good. Doing quite well, actually. Involved in quite a few different things going on this weekend. There are two betas that are happening, one of which I can't really talk about, but let's say it involves...
Well, you can say the name of the thing.
Yeah, it's the WildStars. It's the WildStar stress test. The WildStar stress test is going on this weekend, and the WildStar stress test is, even being a stress test, amazing. I have been excited about WildStar since very early on, but this is the one. Seriously, WildStar. Tell your friends.
You heard it here maybe first.
Yeah, I've been majorly excited about WildStar just from an anticipatory standpoint, but I recognize, you know, we're in an MMO environment that's not exactly conducive to the kind of model that WildStar seemed to be built on, that a lot of MMOs today seem to be built on, which is the older, you know, WoW, EverQuest style model. And certainly when you throw things around like, well, it's going to have a subscription fee and it's going to have 40-man rating and, you know, some of the different things, it seems like, oh, they're just catering to the old school WoW crowd just to try to get them back. But really, there's a whole lot of other stuff that's going along with it. And I think it's going to come out and surprise some people. I really do. I really do. Certainly, I think it's going to do much better than EverQuest, than Elder Scrolls Online will. But...
Elder Scrolls Online has really been getting hammered lately. You would think something coming from a format that seems like it would be relatively easy to translate into an MMO, because you've got the world and the lore and the you would think, you know, it would work out pretty well, but...
Yeah.
But...
Yeah, but I wrote a long article talking about the different reasons why I think Elder Scrolls Online in particular... is a tough sell, especially to the Elder Scrolls crowd. Mm-hmm. And the main thing behind that is the Elder Scrolls franchise has been, especially in recent memory, a single-player franchise, and a ton of freedom is given to the players in terms of, you know, who you can kill, where you can go, what you can do. You know, two people at level 30 look so different. So different. And that's not even thinking about getting up to like levels 90 or 80. I mean, getting maxed out in Skyrim is a huge affair that really only the most dedicated and hardcore people do. And for reasons that don't exactly make the game fun in the broad sense of the term. And the characters that they create, the key problem with doing an MMO versus doing a single player game is the moment you have two characters that share the same space, then there are certain things that have to be met. There are certain balancing acts that have to occur. There are certain things that just have to happen in terms of items, in terms of abilities, in terms of, you know, what if they want to PvP? What if they want to duel each other? What if they want to... There's all these different things that you really have to consider. Otherwise, you know, it kind of winds up looking like Dark Souls, where suddenly you get this random person in the world and you don't know if they're going to wave and drop you like a pack of 10 humanity for you, or if they're going to come at you with legendary weapons just to kill you and just screw your day up. And that might be good for Dark Souls, but for Elder Scrolls and Elder Scrolls Online, you know, you can't just throw two Skyrim players in the same world together. And there are a lot of key things that are part of the Elder Scrolls makeup that just part of its DNA that just get lost whenever you transition over into a traditional MMO environment. You just can't do it that way. It's like if you were to imagine the big map of Skyrim and then start parceling out and say, okay, this hold is supposed to be for first level players. This hold is supposed to be for 10th level players. This hold, that's just for raiders. That's for max level players only. The moment you do that, the internet would burn down. Like, that would happen. If a patch came out tomorrow and changed Skyrim to that, people would riot. That's what we're talking about. And that's, I think, the key thing with Elder Scrolls Online, is that it's taking something that is inherently not conducive to an MMO structure and applying MMO constraints on it. I actually made a pretty good analogy to libertarianism versus not.
Right.
As a reason why, if you're playing Skyrim, you're enjoying libertarian ideal because you're totally free. You can shoot people. You can do whatever you want to do. Yes, there are yes, there are consequences. You got to go to jail and pay a fine and halt, you criminal scum. It was kind of a moment of, it's like, oh, that's kind of funny, but it's actually really true. There are so many shackles and limits and gates that have to be put in place to be able to funnel hundreds of thousands of people
right.
through a game structure and ensure that when they get to the other end of the funnel and they're looking at an entirely different funnel, they all at least have a semblance of the things that they need to be on par with one another. Mm-hmm. You know?
I mean, we've talked about MMOs before and how a lot of developers for MMOs, they come out and they say, it's the MMO, it's the WoW killer, it's the MMO like you've never seen it before, it completely breaks all the rules, and then but we know, we're smart enough to know, there's a reason that MMOs are done the way they're done, because it's the way you have to do it. I mean, there are certain things that an MMO, to be successful and usable, has to accomplish, and, you know, something like kill the pigs and bring me back their snouts...
Yeah.
Is something that in virtually any MMO, unless you go towards something that's really, you know, levelless, and even then it's difficult to get away from that grindy model. That's why we haven't really seen an MMO that you don't have to grind in. I mean, you have certain commodities that every MMO will ask you to spend. Time is... really the one. Time and some amount of natural skill.
Yeah.
And you have to give players the ability to spend time to make money, to get things, to complete quests that are beside money. So the great question for an MMO is, how do we have players use their time? And... you know, you could say, well, then why don't they just make everything really far apart? So you have to, and you have to walk to it. But then people will complain that there's no fast travel and they spend all day walking. When in all reality, you have to make them do something, which is why you get things like pig snouts, because it's going to take you time to do that thing and less time to do that thing as you get a higher level. So... you know, there's a certain way about things.
Yeah.
And until you come up with a game that doesn't rely on that, which in my mind will require, because if you're doing your basic challenge reward repeat structure for a game, challenge reward, challenge reward, challenge reward, then, you know, until you throw in some measure of creativity, you're going to have to, getting the reward is going to have to be a time sink.
Yeah, there are two MMOs out there right now that immediately come to my mind when I think of people that are doing things in a slightly different model. Guild Wars 2 and EVE Online. I've played both of them for several months. EVE Online is different in that you don't necessarily have the same grindiness of it. There are still missions, and you can still do missions. But EVE is really more about the community and how the community affects one another than anything else. They make their videos, they make the promotional videos where they talk about the butterfly effect and the sandbox and, you know, one dust up over here will lead to an entire galactic battle for control, which you think, oh, that's just hype talk. And then you look at a massive, massive battle that had dozens of the most expensive ships in the game being wrecked, all because one player missed a bill payment.
Right.
And then you talk about, well, why do these areas matter? Why are they fighting for control over them other than to say we have control? What kind of logistics do you have to break into when you have European players, when you have Russian players, when you have, you know, North American players, you have Australian players, and they're all coordinating their time zones with one another to make sure that people are logged in at different times, keeping an eye on things. It's different in that the game has moved away from what one of its core aspects might be, which is you can earn money just by going out and running missions for people and killing NPCs. Mm-hmm. But that's seen as kind of one of the lowest of the low. You know, the more intriguing stuff is the stuff that happens from the player base.
Right.
And to an extent, you can't plan that.
No, and that's when you get into creativity. In creativity, once you open it up to players, then you can start getting away from that model. I would say that once you open it up to the creativity like that, to a player's creativity like that, you get away from that challenge reward model.
Yeah.
So,
and EverQuest Next might be able to do, or at least might be able to get more people involved in that because of their terrain builder and structure builder, that whole tool set that's being alpha tested right now, that is going to be a release alongside of that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that's got a lot of people really intrigued about that, because it supposedly is going to have destructible environments and buildings that can be partially destroyed, you know, depending on how it looks. Very, very, very ambitious in that regard. With Guild Wars 2, the way that structure is different in that you don't have a Holy Trinity as much at all. You have a constantly fluctuating effective level, essentially, because you're going into areas that are low level. Even if you're like a 30th level character, your numbers and stats are instantly reduced to being like a 5th level character.
Right.
If you're in an area, you're no longer like, go kill 10 of these boars and bring me their snouts. Instead, you're in a zone surrounding, like in a little field around one person, and that person has a number of tasks that need to be done for them to get by, essentially, or to improve things around here. And you can do any of those things. You can go kill boars all day long. You can go talk to NPCs and try to get them to do certain things for you. You can go dig up materials or engage in other, you know, in-world kind of activities in that zone around that character. And when you've done enough of any or all of them, because they all collectively feed into one pot, then that person is like, oh, hey, you've done all this work and I appreciate that. I will sell you things now. And you get a big reward of karma, which is an in-game currency.
It's essentially the same thing with multiple things you can do for it. And it'd be like a WoW quest giver saying, yes, bring me 6 boar snouts or 20 thorium or 15 mage weave or, you know, something like that. Same sort of deal.
It's actually,
or any combination of the of
exactly. Of the, it's more along the lines of bring me as much of these things, which can be found in this area, as you can.
Right.
Bring me as many boar snouts as you can get, or, you know, or go free these workers so that they can dig up this mineral.
At the end of the day, it's the same sort of thing.
Oh yeah, yeah. You gotta repeatedly push a button. You gotta repeatedly push a thing until you can get the reward,
right,
and then you could move on to the next Skinner box.
Exactly.
And that is likely not really ever going to change.
No.
The only time that you see something breaking that mold is when you're looking at something like EVE Online, in which
when you're looking at something that takes player creativity and makes you know, Minecraft.
They're building their own Skinner boxes now.
Exactly. And part of the time that you're spending is actually creating things, or actually using your brain and coming up with things you want to do. You know, I was watching, I'm going to forget the name of this game, but it's in beta right now, and it's a zombie apocalypse kind of game. But there are a lot of different things you can do.
Like Rust or DayZ?
DayZ, yeah.
Yeah, DayZ is one that's getting a lot of attention for that.
I've been watching some videos for DayZ, and that kind of has is a little more on the EVE model. There was one, you get a lot of people who seem to just want to get together and just sort of do things. There was one that I watched. This is going to sound really bad, but it's not. It ended up being pretty good. There was one video that I watched that these guys were driving, who were all on like an IRC or a Ventrilo style thing where they could talk to each other.
Right.
And they were in a vehicle, they were driving around, and as you get closer to people, you can hear them when they're talking. And the guy said, hey, hold up. And they're like, oh, this is kind of weird. This guy is like, hey, I'm just going to get into the vehicle. So they stopped, and this kid, who's clearly a kid, you know, 10, 12, jumps in the vehicle. They go, okay, well, this is really bizarre, because usually you want to stay away from people you don't know. So they drive the kid out into the forest. because he can't get out now. They drive the kid out into the forest and are essentially they've kidnapped him because they can kill him very easily. They've essentially kidnapped him. Now, the video starts out and you're kind of uncomfortable because they've kidnapped this person that can literally talk to them. I mean, it's an actual person, but they kidnapped this person and they've get him outside the vehicle and they're hitting him with stun guns and stuff like that and telling him, you know, get down on the ground and yelling at him. But the guys kind of, they're having fun with him and they're asking him questions that have no answer. And he gives the wrong answer and they stun him. And it's very funny in a morbid sort of way. But at the end they decide, you know, he's been a good sport. They're not actually going to execute him in the middle of the woods. Though they could have if they wanted to. They're not actually going to just execute him in the middle of the woods. And they ask him a question and he answers it correctly. And they give him a weapon and they protect him from a guy. And they give him this other name. It's very funny. But that it's that sort of thing. It's a lot like if you've ever played a Grand Theft Auto game where you never did any of the missions.
Yeah.
You just kind of go out and have fun. That's the sort of, I think that's another sort of avenue that an MMO could go on. It's just hard to get people to continue playing if you don't give them reasons to.
Yeah.
You know, it's that sort of deal. So you've been playing two MMOs though, right? Two that are in beta or stress testing.
Yeah. I've been playing Wildstar, but I've also been playing, like a lot of people, the Titanfall beta, which is, if you haven't seen anything for Titanfall, take Battlefield, strip out modern day stuff, and replace it with mechs.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been an interesting experience. It looked good. It looked compelling. There's going to be a single player campaign, I believe, but the beta has been primarily the multiplayer. Mm-hmm. And so I've been playing a lot of the different maps and some different modes. One of the things that's actually interesting that I didn't know about the game was that one of the weapons you can get is a smart gun for your layout, for your loadout. And if you keep someone in two broad reticles on either side of your screen, then it will slowly lock onto them.
Mm-hmm.
And by slowly, I mean it can lock on in like a second or a half,
mm-hmm.
you know, which is a kind of a long time in a shooter. And depending on who it is, if it's an NPC drone running around, or if it's an actual PC pilot running around, because it has a lock on three times, when you pull the trigger, the bullet automatically hits them.
Nice.
And, like, kills them. And you can lock onto multiple people at once. So if you run up behind a group and you have your smart pistol out, it'll just start going ping, 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 ping. And it's like, oh, look, there are six people in front of me. I've locked onto them all. Trigger pull. And you're all dead. Which I don't know how I feel about that. I mean, on the one hand, it takes time for it to lock on, and whenever you're pulling the trigger, the lock-on goes away, so you can't just sit here and lock on while you're pulling the trigger, but it's just, I just don't know how I feel about a gun that essentially acts like an aimbot for you,
mm-hmm.
you know? So, eh. But Titans are cool. I mean, being able to drop in a big-ass mech, jump inside of it, jump outside of it, and there's all this parkour that you're doing because you have rocket jets on your back and you can jump around and run on walls and
mm-hmm.
it's a lot more from a traditional shooter like a Counter-Strike shooter or a Battlefield shooter. It's a lot more vertical, especially if you know you want to get the drop on people. The more that you use your environment vertically, the better you will do. And there was one time when I was able to jump on back of a Titan and rodeo it, mm-hmm. and I just pulled out my gun and just completely messed, just shot through its shields and everything and took it all the way down because the person didn't realize that I was on the back. That was fun. So, you know, it's good, but it's a shooter and it's probably primarily going to be, you know, what the Halo kids play.
Yeah.
It's a shooter McShooterson.
And there's nothing wrong with that.
No, if that's what you
do.
If that is the button that you need to have pushed,
mm-hmm.
then it's a good button. It's nice and mech shaped and you know
and you enjoy it quite a bit,
and it says prepare for Titanfall and you get these shivers and
it's pretty good. It's something else that that sort of crossed my radar, unfortunately not fast enough, is you probably know if you're attached to the Facebook that the Netflix original series House of Cards returned I want to say Friday Friday, maybe Thursday, somewhere around
yeah,
in there.
Yeah, I think it came out mid late Friday. Yeah.
Right. And the model is the whole season all at once. So some people have seen all of it. I know Macy has seen all of it.
She watched it all in one day.
Yeah, some people haven't seen all of it. I actually haven't even watched all of last season, but I probably should. And I may do that after a while here. But I bring this up not only because it's an excellent series and is a lot of fun, and Kevin Spacey is great as a bad slash not really bad slash sort of still a bad guy.
Oh, he's... After the end of the first season, from what I understand, you're just like, he makes that turn.
Yeah, that's what I've heard from folks.
Yeah,
he's not a good fella.
Well, we discussed this a bit ago about his character. He starts off as an anti-hero kind of, and then at some point he becomes a straight villain, which we saw that same turn over a much longer period of time in Breaking Bad.
I didn't watch Breaking Bad, so I didn't see nothing.
Yeah.
But I don't really even want to talk about House of Cards, because it is sort of what it is. I do, however, want to talk about Cards Against Humanity, because Cards Against Humanity, which is a fantastic party game put together by just a bunch of dudes that had this good idea for a party game, it ended up becoming the number one toy on Amazon, and they've made boatloads of money for Cards Against Humanity was contacted by Netflix, and they created for Netflix a House of Cards Against Humanity special pack of cards, which is really cool if you're a House of Cards or a Cardsian. Those, they've all since sold out, unfortunately, but you could always go buy them for free, which is Cards Against Humanity's business model. The thing that I find really interesting about this is Cards Against Humanity is a very sort of, you talk anti-hero, they're very anti-company. First of all, they give away everything they produce completely for free. So there's that.
Yeah.
Which you know, is in this day and age incredible and almost hard to believe, but it's completely true.
Yeah.
Literally everything they produce, they post on the website. You can download it and print it out and use it any way you like, or you can buy them. And I have, honestly, I have bought them, so it works. They did this Cards Against Humanity House of Cards thing, and they had to write a blog post about it. And the blog post shows that they don't really even like to work well with other companies.
It's interesting that you have to say that they had to write a blog post.
They were forced to write a
blog. Like it was homework.
Well, it kind of, you get the feeling from the Cards Against Humanity guys that they're naturally funny. They came up with all these cards, and the cards are laugh until you puke funny. They're naturally funny guys, and this is not a lot of work on their part. It's genuinely not. It's cards and stuff written on them, and that's it. I mean, the game, and they've produced a total of four expansion packs. And it's really just, and they sell an empty box to put all of your Cards Against Humanity cards into. If you want, they call it the bigger, blacker box. It's clear that they don't put a lot of effort, at least the kind of effort a ditch digger would spend doing his job, into Cards Against Humanity. I'm sure they put in tons of effort and they love what they do, but I think they would agree that they don't have to do a whole lot. So they give a lot of money away, which is really cool. They gave the money away from Netflix to a company or to a nonprofit that works towards government accountability. I'm going to link this in the podcast page. Go read the blog post that they created for this whole thing. It's just so funny. And the real fascinating thing about this is you kind of look at it from a marketing standpoint, and Russell and I talked about this a little bit before. You look at it from a marketing standpoint, and they're pretty much ripping Netflix a new one on their blog. Like, yeah, they call them suits, and that all the good, they wanted to throw away all the good stuff, and here it is, and they sold this many in this time, and they're even controlling this blog post, so we can't say all the cool stuff we want to say. They're very much too cool for school as far as that's concerned. But, you know, Netflix is getting a bump because Cards Against Humanity is their audience. That's their milieu. I mean, you're talking about a show that begins with an animal being killed by hand by the main character. It goes very well into Cards Against Humanity's their wheelhouse.
Yeah.
So
these are horrible people in power doing horrible things.
Right. And the tagline for Cards Against Humanity is the party game for horrible people. So,
yeah. If you're watching this and getting thrills out of it, then Cards Against Humanity is the kind of game that you would enjoy playing.
I don't. I've said this multiple times on the podcast in the past, but I don't usually buy a lot of party games because I don't usually have a ton of parties or go to a lot of parties with multiple people. But I did buy Cards Against Humanity. I played it over New Year's, and it was a smash hit. People from gamers to complete non-gamers really, really loved it and really enjoyed it. You know, it was good. Go read the blog post. You'll really enjoy it. And you can just download the cards and print them out and use them if you like. Or buy them. Totally up to you. So, you know, give it a go. But you've already missed the Cards Against Humanity cards. Unfortunately, they all sold out in about 45 minutes.
And they can be downloaded.
They can, and yes, those can also be downloaded.
Which, if you've got, you know, a bunch of Magic card sleeves lying around for Magic the Gathering,
you should print them out, cut them out, and put them in the Magic card sleeves. You could be playing by this evening, pretty easily. Yeah. They also have a lot of fan translations, including a pirate, which I didn't even realize. That's hilarious.
It's kind of like Munchkin in that aspect. There's so many different variations of Munchkin.
Uh-huh. That you can do pretty much whatever you want. So, you know, I highly recommend Cards Against Humanity, if only because of their philanthropy or their philanthropic, if only for their philanthropic, you know, doings and the fact that they're just a hilarious company and they create a great game. So, you should be super interested in checking that out. Now, speaking of games, Russell has been talking about a game he's been playing for a little while, which we'd like to talk about a bit. The thing is, I don't know a whole lot about it, so Russell's going to kind of explain it to me, and you get to be along for the ride.
For Numenera. So, this is a game that was originally kickstarted by Monty Cook, and is based in a system that he is kind of calling the Cypher system. Mm. If you're familiar with D20 games, it's similar to that. There are a couple things about the system that attracted me to it, and there are some things about the setting that attracted me to it, because it is weird. And that's kind of been Monty Cook's thing in this game, and also in another game that he's making called The Strange, and I think might be on Kickstarter right now. I'd have to double check that. But he really is trying to inject a level of weird in his games that doesn't get seen much outside of most Call of Cthulhu games or even like Unknown Armies. And Numenera, in it, you play one of three different class types. But even calling them a class is kind of hard because they're only about a third of what make up your actual character. Like, if you think of a class from a traditional D&D game, you're used to thinking of like a warrior, a fighter, a rogue, and you get this very, very, very solid image of what the person typically can do. And the class informs that through variety of, you know, weapons you can use and through different powers and abilities that you gain, like the ability to cast spells or wield heavy weapons, that kind of stuff. With Numenera, the class is only a portion of where you get your stuff from. The traditional way of making a Numenera character is by saying, I am a blank blank who blanks. Like, I am an adjective, noun, who, verbs. Mm-hmm. So in that case, you could say something like, I am an intelligent nano who talks to machines. I am a clever jack who rides the lightning. I am a strong glaive who carries a quiver, or something like that. You know, and each of those things has a different set of skills and abilities that it gives to your character. Like, the descriptor is kind of a little bit of a background, like strong or quick or intelligent. There's a lot of different types, some of which are, you know, really kind of specific to the setting, like mystical or mechanical, and they give you certain boosts and certain skills and certain things like that. Then there is your class, like the glaive or the jack or the nano. Glaives are weapons masters. Nanos can use the Numenera, which is kind of a catch-all phrase for all the crazy stuff that's going on in the world, to do what look like spells. And then jacks are like they're like a multi-class, kind of. They can pick up glaive abilities, they can pick up nano abilities, but at the same time, they don't feel like a multi-class character because the descriptor and the focus, the adjective and the verb, you know, the blank and the blank, add so much to the character that it makes it a really, really, really different kind of character. So that class structure, breaking that apart into three different pieces, is really interesting. But the other stuff that's interesting is, when you're playing a game, the DM is not rolling any dice. The players are rolling all of the dice. They make attack rolls. They make defensive rolls when they are attacked by creatures. Everything has pretty much a set damage type, although you can boost that by spending resources. But the DM can at times intrude upon the action. They can step in and say, oh, you found the switch to open the passageway further. The problem is that the door opening is on the ground and you're standing directly on it and you're going to fall through. And when they do that, when they intrude, they give a player experience. They award them experience for stepping in and saying, hey, I'm going to be a bit of a spoiler here. Or, hey, I'm going to say that this happens. You know, I used that in my game at one point. The players were fighting these creatures that looked like they had been infected by some type of spirit or possessed by some kind of something. And I stepped in as an intrusion to say, you that got hit really hard, you are now infected as well. And I gave them experience. And there are different things that can play along with that, but it leaves the DM in much less of a rules arbiter position. Because the one thing the DM is doing most of the time is deciding, okay, your difficulty level is around here. And that's most of what they do for the mechanics. And really focusing on the story. If they want to step in and you know, push things in a specific direction or change the flow of the story or speed things up, they can intrude at any time. And there are mechanics that are built around that to really help solidify to the players, here is what is happening, and to give them resources that they can use, because they can spend experience both to reroll dice as well as to increase their character abilities. And they can, you know, kind of actively take a part in the story more so than they normally do in most games. And it doesn't exactly feel railroady, because some of these GM interventions, you can spend XP to, you know, overcome them instantly without having to worry about dealing with them. So you spend an experience when your trap door opens and you jump to the side. It's just, it's a lot of different things that are just different enough from the traditional D20 game that I'm used to playing, that it's really been keeping me occupied and keeping me interested for a while. And the setting, because it's set in the far-flung future, is also really cool. It's based around the idea from Arthur C. Clarke that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. This is Earth 1 billion years in the future, where nanotechnology exists, but no one knows exactly what it is. They just know that there are things out there that cause machines to act strange or to cause people to act strange. They know that there are ancient machinery around that they can sometimes scavenge stuff from or can turn on, and that could lead to really bad things or really good things. There's just a lot of really weird things that are going on in the world. I am really drawing a lot of inspiration when I'm playing this from other futuristic but still kind of savage things like Borderlands, from Trigun especially, because there's so much that goes on in Trigun that people just don't understand because they don't know how this technology works. They just do their best to live with it as they can in this really harsh world. And there's all that stuff that's going on that's really compelling to me as a DM and as someone who wants to tell an interesting story at the table.
Would you classify the game as more story-based than action-based?
I would say that it has enough rules that it could be more story-based than action-based. It specifically says in there that, because there's a whole chapter on DMing that is less, here are the rules you need to know as a DM behind the screen, and more, here is how to be a good DM in the mind of Monty Cook and the people that wrote the that chapter, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And the way they describe it is combat should be a challenge to overcome so that you can discover the main, you know, the thing that you were meant to discover anyway. It should be a bump, or it should be a tool to advance the story. Combat should not exist just to get XP, because you actually don't gain XP from killing things.
Right. You only gain XP when the GM steps in and makes you do something.
That's one way that you gain XP. The core of Numenera is in discovery. And so you also gain XP whenever you discover things, either when you unlock a secret, like this entire city is actually, you know, could be turned into a floating city. That's a discovery that earns an XP for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
You find an artifact, which is a, you know, powerful relic of the Numenera, that earns XP for everyone. You discover a hidden secret, like the Aeon Priest at the local clave is actually not who they appear to be. They're a hollow projection that doesn't even realize they're a hollow projection. Something like that, you know? All of those discoveries are what gets you XP, on top of the GM intrusions as well. So when you remove XP as the primary reward for combat, then why exactly are you fighting combat? Because you like combat. That's cool. Here's a lot of combat for you to get through. And here are ways that you can use the combat to advance the story.
Mm-hmm.
You don't necessarily like combat. You want to potentially talk to these people and keep them from, you know, from killing them. Then sure, you can find a way to do that too.
Hmm.
Because the key is, it's kind of like we were talking about with the Skinner boxes at the beginning. The goal as to why you play the game is, to a point, pushing the button is fun. But you also get a reward after that. So the fun of pushing the button is not the only thing that you're having fun with. And when you make that primary, you know, because a lot of my players, whenever they're playing, they're thinking, okay, where can we get items and where can we get XP and how do we get it? And I want to get enough of it so that I can level. That's right. The button they want to push. They want to level. And so they need to get XP. And to get XP, you have to discover things. So they're out exploring as they're getting used to the system. They're doing more exploring. They're asking more questions. They're going into places and asking things. They're not necessarily... And they're still a very kind of bloodthirsty party. They're very, several of them are slayers. They like getting out and they like using their abilities to, you know, to kill things. So they, that's kind of how they build their characters towards. But you don't have to necessarily do that. A lot of what D&D is built around is how to interact with characters primarily through combat. Your weapon proficiencies, your attacks, your actions. Most of that is built around, you know, attacking something.
Mm-hmm.
In this, it's not necessarily built around that.
Hmm. And you're having a good time then playing it.
Yeah, I've stopped my fourth edition game that I was running, and I have replaced that with a Numenera game, which we had to take a break from because people are busy right now. It's Mardi Gras season.
Right.
But I'm hopeful and ready to get back into that. The interesting thing is that it was also designed from the beginning to be, and marketed from the beginning to be, a PDF-friendly game. I bought the first book for it, the main book for it, off of RPG Now at the beginning of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And every month or so, they are putting out supplements that are called Glimmers, that are little $2.99 PDF-only additions to the game. And they can be like a pack of additional ciphers. This past month, they actually put something out for sex and love in Numenera, because it's February.
Mm.
And there's weird enough stuff in Numenera that, yeah, you know,
understanding... that reminds me of one of those splat books from 3.5 D&D when they were just, or third edition D&D when it was in its waning years and people were coming up with tons of really weird splat books.
the open source books, like, here is how all the different breeding pairs work.
Exactly. Like, here's why you don't get half dwarves. Here's how long elves have sex. Like, okay.
This is why dwarves and orcs don't make dorks.
Right.
But they're one of the people that's the main people behind Numenera, I think it's Shanna Germain, is also, I want to say, an erotica artist and or author. So that kind of informs part of where that's coming from. I don't think it's erotica in and of itself, so don't go expecting that. I'm just saying that's, you know, kind of where some of the background is coming from. But it's, and I haven't purchased any of the Glimmers at all. All I bought was the main book, and then I bought the player's guide, which was very cheap, but it was very useful to be able to hand the player's guide out to all my players and say, you know, here are 30 pages you can read, and that'll help you make a character, and reference this list of foci and descriptors to make your character and what you can do.
Mm-hmm.
And then I bought The Ninth World Bestiary is one of the books they just recently came out with, and it's a, you know, big full book of weird creatures as well as NPCs and characters that you can meet out in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that really interested me in that book, as soon as I bought it, I started flipping through the first few pages, and I knew I'd made the right choice to buy it when I came across descriptions of all the different kinds of pack beasts and domesticated animals and how they interacted with a Numenera civilization. Because I've been thinking in my mind for an upcoming thing to tell the players, oh, you're eating this meat. It's a blue meat mixture that comes out of these pipes, and it's called Nutrime, and it smells exactly like, and I almost said steak, and I was like, this is a billion years in the future. Steak does not necessarily exist.
Right.
What is something that is Numenera-y about steak, right? And then I flipped through this book, and I found all sorts of references to pack animals that, you know, are for their meat or for their skin or are kept because they're useful for growing other crops. And there was an entire web, like a life web on one page, showing how a typical Numenera environment, like the full ecology, worked. There are these flowers that produce a pollen, and the pollen is taken in by these weird crypto insects. Then the crypto insects are eaten by these flowers and eaten by these spiders, and the pollen for the flower that was in the crypto insects forms a honey inside the abdomen of the spider, which grows to the size of a large gourd. And then these small hummingbirds come along and they eat the honey out of the spider's abdomen without destroying it, and then fly along. And, you know, this whole weird, it's one of those things that as a DM, you don't think that you're ever going to really tell players, oh, this eats this and that eats that. But it helps inform you.
Yeah, you never know.
About how to immerse them in the world, uh-huh. You know? And as soon as I got that, because I needed to know, oh, it smells like roast Hronther or something. And right. I couldn't figure it out without throwing in Star Trek references. So that was helpful.
Huh. It's good to see a campaign that is set out and done with such care to detail.
Yeah. So, like, whenever we've done two game sessions so far, ran through the entire first session. I had an entire adventure planned out. We ran through it all in the first session, like 7 encounters, or 7 scenes, if you will. The players had these nano spirits that were possessing people and causing them to go crazy. They went to the town that the possessed people were from, which was the Jing community. They lived on this big metal mountain, and they were digging into the mountain and removing as much of the red metal that made it up as possible so that they could salvage it and sell it to other places. And apparently they had discovered this lost thing down at the bottom of it, and they had sealed it up and hadn't been messing with it. But someone from a group called the Convergence, which are kind of these bad guys, showed up and snuck in and then began using it for evil purposes. He began infecting other people in the town with the nanospirits and controlling them through the nanospirits. So the players had to go in. They had to figure out what's going on. One of the players got infected with a nanospirit. So they were kind of having to deal with that too. And they stopped the guy who was at the center of it all. But that wasn't the big thing. The big thing was to figure out what to do with all these people that have these nanospirits in them. And they had a choice at the end. Do they the nanospirits were there for a purpose. Do they allow it to continue its purpose, which would blend the people with the nanospirits permanently? Or do they destroy the nanospirits entirely, which might hurt a few people, but, you know, at least they'd be people by themselves.
Right.
And they chose to keep the nanospirits and blend them with their hosts, so they became these kind of new race of people, or this new kind of weird blended species, which one of the players was as well. And that's going to come up long term in the campaign, and so that's something that we got to do.
Pretty
interesting. They gained experience from, like, discovering, hey, there are nanospirits. Hey, these nanospirits came from this place. Hey, the nanospirits are here for this reason. And then, hey, you discovered an entirely new species of people that you created, and that's where they earned the XP from, not from killing this or killing that.
Would you say you like the game for, because you're, I'm assuming you're running a module of some description.
Actually, no, I wrote that all myself.
Okay. Would you say you're enjoying the game for the rules and how it functions at the table, or do you like it more as a campaign setting?
I think I like it more for the rules and how it functions at the table, because the campaign setting is so weird in several places that I'm having difficulty wrapping my mind around it. Mm-hmm. I also have a lot of my brain space is taken up with campaign settings like Eberron, mm-hmm. and trying to wrap my head around something the size of Numenera while also wrapping my head around the rules is not working. So instead, I have been filling those holes in with stuff that I like, mm-hmm. like Borderlands or Trigun, you know, the sci-fi survivalist post-apocalyptic weird kind of stuff.
Dark Sun kind of stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. That it's built around. So I also like that it is new enough that my players don't understand it enough that mm-hmm. I can do that without them being like, without at least one person in the group being like, well, how does the nation of Karnath and the nation of Ciri play into it? Right. Because ultimately I'm that person.
Yeah.
That's the level. When it's something that I really like and really care about, that's the level of immersion that I get. Mm-hmm. And I'm worried that someone else at the table is the same way.
Yeah. Which you can run into, because we know a lot of long-term gamers and designers who you never know where their interest is going to come from. You never know what sort of information they have just at the, you know, in the back of their mind that they know. Yep. So it's always good to get something interesting and something new.
Yeah, I will say this about the rule set, and this is something that I think makes, because everyone commented at the table that they liked how quickly it ran. Mm. One of the things that you do when you roll, the DM determines a difficulty, and that difficulty is on a sliding scale. And the players, when they roll, are almost never adding any modifiers to their dice roll. Mm-hmm. They are always adjusting the difficulty. So they might adjust it two steps down if they're trained in something and they have a tool that really helps them.
Right.
And that reduces the target number they have to hit, which is always three times the difficulty number. So the players are never adding anything to their rules. They're always saying, okay, I'm going to attempt this. Here are the assets I have in place. I think, okay, roll. They roll. Here is the number I get. I say, you succeeded. You didn't succeed. Hey, you succeeded so well, you had this other thing happen. Mm-hmm. Because they are never adding anything in.
They don't have to think about necessarily.
They don't have to think about it. They don't have to add the numbers together.
Right.
The time is not lost. Keeping up with all the numbers. Because how many times have we stopped and said, oh, wait, you have an additional plus one? How much brain power does that take at the table? Completely getting rid of that does so much to help a game move along.
I'm going to put a link to the Numenera website, which I'm assuming exists.
Yes.
Into the podcast page. If you're interested in Numenera, jump over, check it out.
You can also check out Monty Cook Games, especially if you go to RPGNet, the drive-through RPG. If you go through those places and look out for Monty Cook Games stuff, you can keep an eye on that, as well as The Strange, which is coming out and I believe is going to follow the same cyber rule set.
So you can check that out on the podcast page. We have about 10 minutes. I want to end it talking about something that I experienced this last week that I want to strongly suggest everyone else experience. Now, we talk about a lot of movies on the podcast. One that we mentioned quite a while ago but haven't really been talking about since then, because we tend to talk about superhero movies, things like that, is The Lego Movie. The Lego Movie is currently in the theaters. I saw it Tuesday, maybe Monday, which is the best time to go. If you're where I live, it's the best time to go to the movies. Monday or Tuesday, it's wonderful because there's just nobody there. Might be the funniest movie that I have seen in a couple years in the theater. I laughed until it hurt.
Which honestly surprised me.
It is such an enjoyable movie that it almost instantly becomes your favorite movie. It is so enjoyable a movie that you do not want to miss it. Here's the thing. It's not that you should go see it in the theaters because of the spectacle of the movie, even though it is spectacularly done and it is a lot of fun and is really enjoyable from just a rich visual standpoint, that's not the reason you should go see the Lego Movie. You should go see the Lego Movie because your life is better having seen it. It is, because you just shouldn't wait any longer. That's genuinely the reason you should go see it. I'm seriously considering going and see it again, which I never do. I enjoyed it that much. A couple of friends of mine who've seen it around the same time, they've already gone and seen it again. It is just so, not only is it funny on so many levels that if you have kids, you want to bring your kids would love it and enjoy it. And there's absolutely nothing in it that's questionable if you have that sort of a peccadillo about with your children. If you want to go see it by yourself, you're going to love it so much. And not only is it a great movie that you'll love if you're a big fan of Lego, as I am, if you're not a big fan of Lego, you're still going to love it. It's also, shockingly enough, now if this was just a regular kids movie and it was Lego, it would have done really well. We would be looking at 3 and 4 sequels. It's also an incredibly good movie. Just from movie standpoint, not from, it was really funny, but just from an actual story standpoint, it's really surprising. From a story standpoint, from you know, the writing, the fact that it's incredibly funny, it's the sort of movie that you don't need to take any more time in having not seen. Go see it as soon as you get the opportunity to. You will absolutely not regret it. It is, I give it my absolute highest praise. Loved it, would see a million times.
I'm still shocked, frankly.
It is so damn good. It's just, it's, I mean, everyone talks about how funny it is. It is incredibly funny. Literally every single character in the movie that you deal with is funny. And has lines. Will Arnett as Batman is great. Jonah Hill is Green Lantern, which you don't really realize until you get into the movie. There are so many little bit parts that people play that are funny. There are so many little touches, little attentions to detail that Lego's known to be a very detail-oriented company. It shows in this movie. Just every little, the song for the movie is great. They have a song that plays a minor part in the actual movie. It's actually a song done by Tegan and Sarah and The Lonely Island.
Oh, damn it. I'm going to have to watch it for that alone.
I'm going to send you a link to the song. It's maybe the most catchy pop song you've ever heard in your life. It's called Everything is Awesome.
See, I knew something was up with this when there's a webcomic I follow, Short Pact, mm-hmm.
I used to read Short Pact, and then it kind of shit the bed, so I stopped.
Yeah, but it's about people that work at a toy store, and so there's a lot of toy-centric humor to it, and one of the characters, it's the shot inside her mind, it's like, I'm sorry, Bruce Tim Batman, the Batman from the Batman animated series, Kevin Conroy Batman, you're not the best Batman anymore. What? Who could possibly? And then he turns into Lego Batman.
Yeah.
At that point, I was like, holy, really?
It's the funniest Batman for certain. It's, I don't want to give anything about the movie away because I went into it pretty much completely blind, and it's so much fun, and things happen where I was literally in the theater between laughing hysterically, between giggling hysterically, between occasionally going, oh my god, that's blah blah blah, between occasionally going, oh my god, oh my god, oh my god, as you just freak out because something is, because they take, and I don't want to give anything about the movie away, but they take the playsets that Lego has produced, much of it licensed from other sources, and they use them. Like, it's, I don't want to give anything of the movie away, but it is based on existing playsets. Everything in the movie is done by Lego. In fact, there's at the very beginning, the main character Emmett takes a shower. His shower spits out Lego water, as in it's not actual water. It's like little blue, single Legos, and then like foam is like little white single. The fire is actual Lego fire, like the little pieces that are little sculpted, and they have little, like, everything is Lego except all the stuff that's clearly not Lego. But you have to watch the movie to see, because I love this movie so much I don't even want to give that much away. Go and see it immediately, if not sooner. You'll freak. It's that good. It is a nerd's movie through and through, and you will love it. You have my guarantee. I'm yet to meet anybody who's seen it and even thought it was okay. It's got a 96 on Rotten Tomatoes right now, primarily because you're always going to get two or three critics, especially for something like the few, like, not good reviews I saw started off by saying, well, it's a huge commercial for Lego, which it's not. It's just not.
Well, you did just describe that it brings up all of the playsets.
I mean, I guess if you want to look at it like that, it will rekindle your love of wanting Lego and wanting to build with Lego. But it's so much more than that. That would be like calling the James Bond franchise a big commercial for Walther arms. Hmm. Like, there are Walther guns, and you think they're cool because he uses a PPK, but it's only, I mean, sure, it reinforces the brand, but it's not a commercial. You're not getting long looks at, you know, the gun, and there's not like a subtle buy now, or, oh, the Walther guns are the best. You know,
if you get past the fact that it's called the Lego movie,
right,
then you already have accepted, oh, this is a movie that involves a product that I can go buy. And then that thought process has ended and moved on.
It's as much a commercial for Lego as the Avengers is a commercial for Marvel.
For Marvel or for Shawarma?
For Marvel. Well, only one part is a commercial for Shawarma. No, it's as much a commercial for Lego as the Avengers is a commercial for Marvel. Yeah, it's really awesome. That's like saying any movie that's really good is a commercial for whatever it is that's in the movie. That's like Saving Private Ryan is a commercial for World War II. I mean, it's stupid. Want me to make a shitty movie that it's not a commercial? I mean, it is. You have to go see it. That's my last word, is you have to go see it. That's really all you need to know. Just go see it. And if you disagree with me, then, as always, our music is Outprop featuring Esset. Check them out on uhort.no. You can check us out on Twitter. We're at GIR Podcast. If you didn't like the Lego movie, tell me. Send us a tweet. Say, hey, Jeremy, I didn't like the Lego movie. We'll have you on the podcast. I want to dissect your brain like a Roswell scientist. I want to know why you didn't like the Lego movie. I want to know what is wrong with you. Because it's something. You can also shoot us an email to girpodcast@gmail.com. I will also accept emails and maybe do a little email interview. We'll get to the bottom of this. We'll help you out. But for now, this is Jeremy. That's Russell. Thanks for listening.
As always, no dogs, Lego or otherwise, were strangled in the making of this podcast.